Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. This is the panel on what is the role, excuse me, the Mormon lit scene today, not the debate. We're not debating. So go ahead, Catherine, and introduce yourself.
Oh, okay. I am Catherine Morris. So I work on, it's a website where you can find out about Mormon artists. We do interviews. Our most recent new exciting thing has been that we have a podcast. So this is our website. Mormon is pretty simple, mormonartists.net. And we have interviews with a lot of artists. I think over 180 artists we have interviews with. And we interview all kinds of artists. We do interview authors, so we have little tags. Like, you can click on fiction, and it'll show a lot of the authors we've interviewed. But we also interview visual artists and musicians and dancers and sculptors and animators and all kinds of artists. We also have some articles. Our most recent one is by Scott Hales, which gives an overview of early Mormon literature from 1830 to 1890. So we do have some articles. We don't have a lot of those, but we do have some. And most recently, we started a podcast in October, and I do the interviews for these. We publish every 2 weeks, up to twice a month, sometimes three times a month, depending on what's going on. So these, again, kind of continue the interviews, but also I went to Comic-Con, FanX, in this year, and stalked all of the Mormon artists and authors I could find there and did little interviews with them. So I also do cover some events. And actually, I'm going to be doing a special podcast on this event. So if anyone wants to be interviewed, let me know.
Okay, cool. But. So I'm Nicole Wilkes Goldberg. I'm married to James Goldberg, so that's why I'm here, which is really all I can say.
Makes sense that you were there.
I know. Well, it's because he was there. He was like, we need somebody else on this panel, and I want you to talk about the Lit Blitz. So I co-edit the Mormon Lit Blitz with him and the other online contests that we do with the Flash Fiction and those kinds of things. And so that's my brief introduction. Every time we're talking, okay. Let's just pass it.
I'm Boyd Peterson. I am the program coordinator for Mormon studies over here at UVU. I've been teaching Mormon Lit for about 10 years, I guess, now. And I'm the new editor of Dialogue, which I have no idea what I'm doing yet. So hold your applause for 5 years.
I'm Laura Hilton Craner. I write some stuff sometimes. I live out in Colorado, so this is, like, really fun that I'm here today. I'm a single mom. I'm an avid reader and, I don't know, just everything with Mormon Lit, the Mormon art scene. I do as much as I can from the other side of the Rocky Mountains. I blog occasionally these days with the Motley Vision. About 5 or 6 years ago, I was interviewing people, doing a lot more writing online. And James asked me to sit on the panel and talk about sort of the intersection of my regular life and Mormon Lit and how that has, so I guess that's my expertise because I don't have the publication chops that the rest of you guys have yet. So, yeah. Hi. Yay for being here. Thanks. There's lots of people in the room.
Okay, so. Are you ready or do you want me to go?
I can go. Well, I just thought it would be fun to do a little... a very, very short Mormon literature quiz. I have caramels for those who want to participate. Also, if you...
It's okay,
the panelists are disqualified from this quiz. And if you ask a question, you can also be eligible to get a caramel. So, I don't know if someone... wants to pass this out, but Would someone like to pass these?
I thought you were going to throw them at people who are at least, oh, throw them at questions. Yeah, yeah, like throw them questions for some candidate. See, I don't have this kind of teaching experience, so some of you, you need to, you need to, you need the incentive there, Catherine. Okay, okay, close your eyes, everybody, okay, because you're going to see the answers. Don't look. Do you want to blank the screen? Okay, um,
so, know your Mormon author. These are pretty easy if you're kind of in the know. But if you're not, they could be difficult. Okay, this author won a Newbery Honor, one of the most prestigious awards for children's literature, in 2006. Let's hear, let's see if any of Boyd's students knows. Any children's authors that you can think of who are LDS? Serena, would you like to consult the gentleman in front of you? Would you like to consult the gentleman sitting right in front of you?
Shannon Hale.
Oh, maybe. That's a good guess. Okay, you guys both get... Do you want black licorice or caramel?
Caramel.
Caramel?
Throw it hard.
This could get really dangerous. Do you want caramel? Okay. There you go. Okay, some more details.
You need to be the passenger.
Yeah, not really. I need more practice, apparently. She collaborated with Stephanie Meyer and Jerusha Hess to make a film starring Kay Russell for her novel Austinland. In addition to writing young adult literature, she also writes some, I think Austinland is chick lit, actually. And her recent blog post, No Boys Allowed, School Visits as a Mormon Writer, went viral. So she's actually, if you follow her Twitter account, she talks a lot about being a female writer. And she recently talked about visiting schools. She has a lot of school visits. And it doesn't happen often, but every now and again, they don't really let the boys go to see her because her protagonists are female. So she wrote a post about it recently that generated some discussion, which was interesting. And her most well-known children's novels are Princess Academy, which is the one she won the Newbery for, and Goose Girl, which is a series. I think there are three in the series.
There's four.
Four? Okay.
They're all awesome.
Shannon Hale! Congratulations. That was correct. Okay.
And her newest book, Dangerous, has the most hilarious, hilarious protagonist. So if you just want to fall in love with a one-handed sci-fi protagonist, read Dangerous. She's amazing.
Ringing endorsement. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, she, her, I've read Mrs. Academy, and it was really fabulous. Okay, this author won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards, science fiction's top U.S. prizes, 2 years in succession, something no author has ever done. Guesses? Yes. Orson Scott Card. What was your name again?
Ari Christmas.
Ari Christmas. Okay. Would you like a caramel? Okay. I'm just going to do the caramel. If someone wants licorice, you'll have to do a special request. I thought about just getting two of these, but... okay. He won the American Library Association Margaret A. Edwards Award for his significant and lasting contributions to young adult literature in 2008. His fantasy novel, Seventh Son, is inspired in part by the life of Joseph Smith. Have you guys read Seventh Son?
We just read it this week.
Did you like it? It's really great. And his most well-known book is Ender's Game, which, by the way, he kind of hates the movie, so don't talk to him about it. Actually, if you do, he'll have a lot to say about it. Orson Scott Card. Okay. This is the last one. It's going to get a little bit more tricky. This author writes crime fiction set in Victorian England. Jesse?
Ann Perry.
Okay.
I think Melissa's going to get caramel, too.
Did she help you?
No.
She did.
We're just having arguments about reason.
Okay. She sold over 20 million copies of her books worldwide. The Times London selected her as one of the 20th century's 100 masters of crime. And she is quite prolific. She has two series, her William Monk novels and her Charlotte and Thomas Pitt novels. And she writes one of each every year. When I interviewed her, she said she writes, I think she writes 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. So that was when I realized that I didn't want to be a full-time author.
Most full-time authors don't do that.
Kathy. I know. I think Brand Sanderson writes like 4 to 6 hours a day, but yeah. She's quite prolific. And Perry. So I just thought that would be kind of a fun introduction to kind of, these are some of, we've actually interviewed all three of these authors, and as you can see, there's quite a variety. One of the things I wanted to mention was, so we try to cover all genres with Mormon artists. We do end up interviewing a lot of science fiction and fantasy authors and children's authors because there are a lot of Mormons who write science fiction, fantasy, and young adult and children's literature. Anyway.
Okay.
That's my
question. Cool. Thank you. And we will have time, hopefully, for questions after we each go through the different things. So I actually have felt like what I should be doing, can you blink that, is maybe dispel some of our preconceived notions about different types of Mormon works that are out there. I wanted to start with Deseret Book, because I know Deseret Book tends to, you know, induce that eye-rolling sort of, you know, response when people who tend to be more literary think of Deseret Book. They think, oh, it's just so trite. So when I was an undergrad, I actually worked at Deseret Book in the bookstore, and most of our customers were looking for gifts. And so that was something that, you know, like, I actually liked being at gift wrap and going and wrapping those books. It was really fun. And it was a really fun environment and a really good, nice place to be, you know, for a 20-something, and I enjoyed the space. But I kind of want to talk for a little bit just about maybe why Deseret Book and the associated publications matter amongst the Mormon lit scene today. Why this is something that we should care about. Like, we've got our nationally renowned authors, like Catherine has mentioned, but then we have so many local authors that the place and really niche authors, the place that they have found a home has been at Siegel Book and Deseret Book. And I just want to say, from my personal opinion, there's nothing wrong with that, because it's a safe space. And there's actually something quite valuable to that. Having read, you know, a lot of Pulitzer Prize-winning novels, and if anyone's read, like, Philip Roth's American Pastoral, you know that's not something you want to share with your grandmother. But you do know that, like, I know I can get those Deseret Book titles, the nonfiction and the fiction, for my grandfather, who really loves the nonfiction and wants to read that kind of stuff. And so there is sort of that safe space with the Deseret Book readers. And also, a lot of people go there because they want the more gentle books. They don't want things that are, they're suddenly going to be like, wait, what? There was this sex scene and it was totally unexpected, and or, you know, brutal violence, those kinds of things. Now, the problem that we have, the reason I think we resist this is this realism, right? There is this question. Are we getting a realistic perspective on how people live their lives? And I think that's a totally legitimate question. And so that's why we don't want to say the only thing that you should read in terms of Mormon literature should come off the shelf of Deseret Book, because I think there's a lot more out there and there's a lot more to explore, and that's something to keep in mind. And so we want to make sure, what I want to say is be open, but know that the niche market is working within that niche and for the reason. And actually, if you look at the changes in the publishing world over the last 10, 15 years, especially, you know, as more and more information is becoming available online and we have more, you know, ebooks and these kinds of things, publishing houses have really pulled back. I've got a friend who, she was published by a national publisher, and Barnes & Noble said, no, we're not going to carry her book. The publisher pulled their backing from her book. And while she still can work with them, nobody picked up the book there. They stopped promoting it and those kinds of things. So this can be a real problem if you get the one major chain bookstore out there saying, no, we're not going to do this, then suddenly your book, even if it's published by one of the big five, is, you know, kind of out in the cold, and it doesn't move on from there. And so we need, you know, we do have something kind of cool with Deseret Book as a publishing house and a retail market, because you get this very tight and quite selective, and I'm not saying they're open to change, so I don't want to say that at all, but a very selective editorial staff that will promote these books within the bookstore. And there is something to be said about that. So I think we need to acknowledge that that is something. And of course, I think we're all familiar that it's been about 15 years since Deseret Book launched their other imprints, like Shadow Mountain, and that has actually been really successful nationally. I mean, if anybody ran across Fable Haven in your Barnes & Noble and when Borders existed?
In your Walmart.
In your Walmart, yeah. And I think it was at Costco, yep, as a set. You know, and so this is a pretty cool thing they're doing with some of their imprints. And while there are, it is limiting, no doubt. Like, they do limit what they publish and what they consider to be worthy to be on their shelves. It is someplace that I think we can look to. And I just want everybody to think for one second, maybe Orson Scott Card aside, but what was the first book by a Mormon author that you read? Anybody think of it?
Jayhawk.
Was your first? Really? Anybody else have one? Chris Hyman, the Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites? Yeah.
The Backslider
was your first. Wow. See, not on the Deseret bookshelf.
This is AML.
I know.
This novel about missionaries that I mentioned, like, the 60s or 70s. I don't remember the title or anything at all. My dad has a copy of it.
But that was the first one you ran across. I was 11 when I read Charlie by Jack Wayland. Okay? So, yeah, I see a lot of other people going, oh, yeah, Charlie. Right? Like, I was super excited to have another Mormon character, you know, like, to be able to see what Mormon characters were doing, because I had been reading Nancy Drew and that kind of stuff, and so there is a value in saying, having these characters out there, having other Mormon characters, I think there's something to that. So that's kind of what I wanted to be able to say with that. Yes.
The giant Joshua
was the first one. Awesome. But that's not when you're reading it.
No.
I want to revise mine. Jayhawk was the first good one I read.
And see, that that is actually, I think that's legitimate, right? Because I and I'm not saying like we should all go to Deseret Book now, because as much as I tried and everybody was like, oh, the work of the glory is so fantastic, I can't get through it. You know? And so
Where nothing is long ago. That's a more classic.
Yeah. Yes. So there are a lot of great works out there. So I just wanted to kind of bring that up. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about that we may have a little bit of resistance to is online publication. And I think I have a bit of a vested interest in this because my husband and I edit the Mormon Lit Blitz every year, which is coming up in May. Okay, people should submit. And it's flash fiction or short poems and short essays, 1,000 words or fewer. But we've had some really interesting experiences with this. And it's been a nice way to build a literary community as well, in addition to things like AML. We've actually had people come over for dinner or, you know, just gotten together with people that we met through the Mormon Lit Blitz. And so a lot of people are sort of resistant to, okay, is it very legitimate if it's just online? I'm going to tell you that we go through a really rigorous selecting process. We read everything. We decide. We see how pieces are talking to each other. And then we edit the pieces. And we give editorial notes back to the writers. And so it's not just a matter of, like, oh, whatever you sent us, we'll throw it online. And so I just want to make sure that's pretty clear. So it actually started with a conversation between James and with Scott Hales. They were talking about, can literature go viral? And it was an interesting question. And we actually saw this happen with our first Lit Blitz piece. And I just want to read a little bit of it. And we decided this was going to be the opener, and we really liked the way that it opened the Lit Blitz. This was 4 Lit Blitzes ago, so 3 years ago. So this is called In Bulk by Marilyn Nelson. It's a poem, and it starts with a little epigraph. But as good as the price per ounce may be, you just don't need that much mayonnaise. CBS Money Watch, 5 things you should buy at Costco. And she says, it is tempting to begin aggressively, to ask what you, with your elevators and your buzzing in, your taxis and your tiny drooping houseplants, your holiday parties and your solitary coffee breaks, know of shouting, giggling masses of children bursting like not quite sentient maggots from the secondhand, mortifying station wagon. But that would limit the scope of this argument, which I admit began relatively blandly with mayonnaise, to be precise, which is sort of a metaphor for blandness, but which will flourish in the potato salad of my indignation. Favorite line, just so you know. Until it is perfectly seasoned, surprising, and delicious. So I will say instead that you must have kept your life beneath the veil of city lights, unlike Wordsworth, and yes, me, we who love stars and are habituated to the vast. You must never have known contented crowdedness, 2 to a bed whispered and whispers and tangled feet, enough space in your eyes to hold the desert sunlight, elbowing its way over the mountains at dawn and blazing up like brush fire in the evenings. And so it is unreasonable to expect you, your compact refrigerator and your collapsible umbrella, to conceive abundance. Oh, but do not think it is not real, though perhaps you have not met it in your dimlit halls. I find it daily, sifting down into my 50-pound bags of flour, nesting contentedly in my gargantuan cartons of eggs. Here, it falls down on us like stardust. My children run laughing through its showers. We shake it, shining from our hair. So this didn't actually win the first Mormon Lit Blitz, but it had 2,000 views. Now, anyone who has ever published in a literary magazine knows that you have not ever had 2,000 people pick up your literary magazine and read your piece. And it's kind of sad to say that, but it's just sort of the reality of how these things work. So So we're kind of excited to see that sense that the literature can be viral, and that's what online publications can do. And I think we've had some really cool discussions online, and even people afterward talking about different pieces, and it gives us a lot of room, whereas that Deseret Book model seems to be really limiting. We have a lot of space for experimenting and seeing what, you know, what people can do and how people can experience things. And we have a lot of new writers, people that we've never seen before, as well as more established writers who contribute. So that's all.
Well, the debate's supposed to be in the other room, but let me, I'm really tempted to wax Book of Mormon-ish here. And call Deseret Book the Whore of Babylon, but I won't.
I do if you controversial, really.
Pollyanna of Babylon, okay, maybe that's... I think one of the biggest problems with Mormon literature is that it's become a genre fiction rather than an accepted part of the literary scene. As somebody who teaches Mormon literature, I have colleagues who tell me there's no such thing as Mormon literature. And as hard as I try to convince them that that's wrong, that there are, now I can't think of her name, Virginia Sorensen and Maureen Whipple out there, as well as some really terrific stuff right now, it's really hard to convince them that when what they're seeing on the shelves is Twilight and Tennis Shoes Among the Nephites. I think one of the problems with Deseret Book is you said it's safe. Safe's fine if you're wanting to find a place to sleep. Safe's really great. I'm reminded of what Captain Grace Hopper said about ships. She said, a ship in port is safe, but that's not what ships were built for. And I think the Mormon audience has come to this belief that safe is what we're supposed to be, that the idea is to come into this world innocent like a child and leave it innocent like a child, rather than innocent like a sin-free person who has knowledge. Mormonism, like no other religion I know of, speaks of acquiring knowledge and experiencing the world. And Joseph Smith's talk about probing the depths of the universe, I think, is really not something you can do at Deseret Book, frankly. I'm reminded of an essay by Travis Anderson that he published, and I think he gave it as a devotional years ago, but he talked about how his parents, he came to his parents' house one time, and they were watching some mindless thing on TV, and he kind of criticized it and said, this is kind of trashy. And they said, oh, it's wholesome entertainment. And so he riffs on this notion of wholesome. What's wholesome? It seems like our Mormon audience would be quite content living on pizza and candy instead of getting any vegetables. And so for me, I think that the most important Mormon literature published today is found in Zarahemla Press, Signature Book, Parables Press, a lot of self-published stuff. And the pages of journals like Sunstone Dialogue, BYU Studies. One of the problems, though, I see in an organization like Deseret Book, who they have the resources to invest in great art, and what we really need to develop great Mormon literature, I think, are editors who are willing to work with authors, and I don't find that too much in the scene today.
About just first class Mormon literature.
Yeah, exactly.
Forget about the great.
Yeah, first class.
If we talk about great Mormon literature, I don't know what great Mormon literature is.
Well, you've written several things. I think you've written quite a few things that I would classify as great. But it, you know, you probably don't go to Deseret Book as often as I do, so maybe that's why you don't recognize the greatness of your stuff.
I mean, it's great for another one.
Um, Let me just conclude with a quick comment that I think shows you the kind of puritanical, Pollyanna-ish notion of safe that I think Deseret Book operates under. My brother-in-law, I published the biography of Hugh Nibley, and my brother-in-law published his war memoirs. And we had very different approaches. Mine was more of a footnotes, scholarly type of book. His was more, he envisioned more of a coffee table visual book. And if you've seen his book, it's called Sergeant Nibley, PhD. He has a lot of things in the margins. And so in his introduction, he talked about and used the word marginalia. And the editors at Deseret Book were so concerned about that word. And he was baffled. Why do you have a problem with marginalia? Well, it sounds too much like something else. I guess genitalia was the only thing we could figure. But the fact that their editors are focused solely on, is it going to offend somebody? And I think we need to get beyond this notion that we need to be taken care of. We can grow up and find things that we like, and if we don't like, if we get to page 60 and there's a book that we don't like, we can set it down. There's nothing that says you have to keep reading. And so I'd really like to see the Mormon audience grow up a little bit, frankly. So there's my 2 cents.
Okay, so I guess I'm coming at this from the other end of things. As a consumer of Mormon literature, not so much as a producer or a shaper of the Mormon lit scene, sometimes a small contributor. I have no way to talk about Mormon literature without it being personal, because I think, for me, that's what it is. It's a very personal thing. It's very much about, I had an eight-hour drive, in the middle of the night last night to get here, and I had a lot of time to sit and think, because even the gas station, like convenience stores, are closed in the middle of the night, so I couldn't even buy snacks to keep myself busy. And as I thought over this, it really was, for me, Mormon literature matters because it's a question of identity. It's very much about trying to figure out who I am in the world. I think, there's that thing we always say about Mormon lit, that it's too Mormon for the regular publishers, but it's not Mormon enough for Deseret Book or whatever. And I feel like for a lot of us as humans, especially for myself, I feel very much like that's my own personal story. I started college concurrently when I was in high school. I was 16. I started college. I finished when I was 20. I was raised in Logan, Utah, so I was a very good Mormon girl, did a lot of really good things, and I'm not sad about that, but I ended up getting married at 19, which I keep telling people was not a bad choice at the time that I made it. It wasn't. If I had to go back and make that choice again, I'd make it differently, but I'm much older now. And so I was married for 12 years, and I had 4 kids, and, I thought that following all, you get your Young Women's Medallion, you go to college, you get married, I got my lit degree. I followed my husband out to Colorado for his job and started having babies and was writing at home. And I thought, this is the Mormon way. This is going to be, I'm going to be happy. Everything's going to be okay. But my marriage was not we were married in the temple. We did all the good Mormon things, but it wasn't what I was promised it was going to be. And these kids, it was so much harder. And so really when I got invested in the Mormon lit community was actually after I left Utah. And I was out in Colorado having these really colicky babies and this really difficult marriage and being very depressed, very lost in the world. And I was sitting in Starbucks one day with my kids and it hit me, I could just go buy a coffee and nobody would care. Whereas growing up in Utah, if you did that, people are going to look at you funny, right? And so it was this question of, where do I fit in the world? And it became searching out these Mormon stories that were not necessarily a Deseret Book stories, because my own life was not a Deseret Book story. No matter how hard I was trying to spin it as one, it just was not. I started with the AML website. I just went there and found all the award winners and said, I'm going to read all these and I'm going to figure this out. And, the blogger knackle was pretty big, and so I kind of got into AMV and different things that way. One of the first books I read was probably The Backslider by Levi Peterson. And this book and I really had a very difficult time, because if you've read the book, it is, I don't know how to describe
hard.
It. It's a hard book. There were some things in there, and it was really, it shook me on a very deep level. It really shook me to think, especially, I was probably 20, 21-ish when I read it. And maybe not old enough to appreciate it, I guess, or experienced enough, but you get to the end and there's the Marlboro Jesus, right, with a cigarette and the urinal, and there's this whole thing, and you're like, no, Jesus is this guy with a very nicely trimmed beard and very, you know, Jewish, but you know, not frizzy hair, and like he's just very like pulled together. He's not the Marlboro man at a urinal. Except that image, as much as like it put me off and I like dropped the book and walked away from it. The cheese grater on the knuckles too. Yeah. That was really rough for me at the time when I read it. That just hit me so hard. And Alice as a character is such a thing. But that Marlboro Jesus has stuck with me, and as I've been through these things where my own Mormon story doesn't fit the Mormon narrative, I look back at that Marlboro Jesus and I go, you know what, maybe there's a lot more to that than I gave it credit for, because that has stayed with me. And there have been moments when I've been like, you know what, right now in my life, I'm in a low spot. And the Jesus sitting next to me is the Marlboro Jesus. He's the one who's in that space with me. I have a similar relationship with the books as Zarahemla books. Some of them, like I find them and it's like, oh, you know, and like everything in my life is fulfilled because, you know, this is beautiful and wonderful. And then some of them really push me, make me uncomfortable. And I go, what did I just read? Like, I'm not sure about this, but all of it adds this texture to these Mormon stories, and I think it gave me space as a consumer of Mormon literature and as a Mormon person in this world to be fully human, to not worry about having that Sunday face all the time that sometimes I think we feel the pressure to have. One of the books that I read last year, Mile 21 by Sarah Blackham Dunster, it really is, in a lot of ways, it conforms to the chick lit genre, if you guys have read it, I don't know. But in other ways, because Abish is kind of it's not really a very friendly character, people don't like her, she got some pushback from a lot of readers, even though it is a very safe book. Like, if you're looking for a safe book, this is one you can give people. But it really rocked me, because even though it was a safe book, where I was in my own, like, post-divorce single mom journey, and, you know, I just picked up running and whatever, like Abish, And the dark spaces she went through, even though they weren't super dark because it's chick lit, it really gave me some space to sit with myself and be like, you know what, this is okay that I'm struggling. The space that I'm in is actually really difficult. And so that's, I don't know, for me as a consumer of Mormon literature, someone who really goes a long way to find it, to purchase it, to interact with it, it has been very valuable in my life because it is that identity and it just rounds things out. So we've all been doing a lot of talking, and I'm going to stop, so maybe you guys can say something. Questions? Comments?
We have a question?
Yeah, sure. What happens next? Who's in charge? Nicole?
No.
I think it's the Carmels that are in charge.
Yeah, this is your incentive to ask questions or say something insightful. Did you want to ask a question or say something insightful, Gideon?
Yes. So the Mormon lit scene today, I wonder, I mean, there's been a little discussion about Deseret Book as one scene. There's also discussion of finding and consuming and producing literature online. That's another scene. Sometimes they overlap a bit. Here's another scene, you know, here we are at this meeting. It's infrequent and sparsely attended, that worthy but few. It's another scene. Some people teach Mormon literature, and that's another scene. I'm wondering, have we gotten all the scenes? I think there are a few, and I'm curious if we've really tabulated them all, because I don't think that any one of them is the whole scene. But
no.
They do overlap a lot. I think there's another scene that is people who are producing Mormon content, but it's not necessarily literature or literary. Maybe that's where Mormon artists fits in. It seems to me there's a lot more Mormon content being produced now, but I'm saying the word content because you wouldn't call it literature. You know, you've got Melissa doing a web series right now. And is that literature? Is that part of the Mormon lit scene?
Well, I think anything involving the written word is literature.
Okay. I have a broad definition myself, but I think a lot of
times... I can see how you would get content. When
we have these discussions, it either lapses back to a kind of academic literary studies notion or a niche Mormon market scene. And I do think it's there are cracks in that. Or maybe I wonder what your opinions are about the breadth of the scene.
I would say the breadth of the scene is every Mormon reader. right? Like, you're never going to get every scene, every whatever tabulated, because what happens with you in a book, like, you guys are going to have an experience even in a book. So I think you're never going to get every scene pulled together, because it is about that individual. And that's why the online scene, that's why all the content, that's why the stuff Catherine does, everybody does, right, matters, because it brings those individual scenes together into something bigger. But I don't think you can ever get all of it tabulated or put together, because it's an individual communal space.
I guess my frustration is the other word, seen. There's so much Mormon literature that is never seen by so many people, because there's this kind of monopoly there, and, sure, and so many people think Deseret Book has the imprimatur. And I'd just like to see that open up. You know, my frustration isn't that the Academy doesn't, you know, I would like to have my colleagues think there is such a thing as Mormon literature. But I'd like to have people in the Mormon community know that there's something besides those things that are safe. So that's my real frustration there.
It seems to me what you need is some Mormon criticism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Mormon, forget about Deseret Book. I mean, they're not in the ballpark.
Yeah.
About the kind of literature we're talking about. We're talking about serious, thematic literature that deals with life and the experience of life and the failure of life,
yeah,
as well as moments of triumph and so on. But there is no publisher, there is no Mormon publisher that, well, first of all, there's no criticism. We don't have criticism, someone to tell us what's, help us understand what's good and what's not good. We don't have Association of Mormon Letters. I've been online and I've found about 15 different sites that actually talk about Mormon literature one way or the other. But for the most part, they're superficial, they're quick. There is no place you can go, in my opinion, based on my experience, where you can find someone or an organization or a journal who has insightful people who are writing about and evaluating Mormon literature to help readers find what's worthwhile. And also the responsibility of teaching what's worthwhile. We just don't have it. We have, you know, these various, as I say, 12 or 15 sites that I go to. But I don't know how you're going to get it, frankly. But one of the things we need is somebody, group of people, as far as I'm concerned, responsible, intelligent, insightful people who are evaluating Mormon literature. Forget about Deseret Book. They're in a different category. But who's going to help us?
Well, I think Motley Vision does a lot of that for the Mormon world and AML. We've had problems with websites.
It's recognized as a major, yeah, and people who are looking for Mormon literature will go there.
But in the outside community, this question, and actually I mentioned it, came up in my department. Is there such a thing as Mormon literature? So I went through the MLA database just to see if there was a Mormon literature. And if you type in Mormon literature, you'll only get a few hits. There's not very many things out there. But if you type in individual authors, you soon find that there is a Mormon criticism, and it's published in national journals. But I think, you know, if you're going to have criticism, you also have to have people reading the criticism. And
And I think the other problem is the Mormon lit community is small, right? I mean, we're small. I have teacher voice. This is my first year as a full-time teacher, and every weekend I lose my voice. And then I get it back Monday, and then I lose it Friday. So I will try to be louder. Thank you for telling me. I think one of the problems with, or one of the hurdles, maybe, to developing the criticism you're kind of looking for is that the Mormon lit community is very small. And so we all would end up, and criticism, I think the other thing, and this is a benefit to that small community, is the Mormon lit community is also very compassionate. We're kind to each other. Even when we review people's stuff that we don't like, we're kind and we're patient because we know that somebody has sacrificed, you know, that they probably have 7 million small children at home and a day job and I mean, or who knows what, right? Like they're doing their callings and they're doing all of these other very Mormon things while they're producing this Mormon literature, and that anything that gets published has been through so much blood, sweat, and tears that I think we're all very kind and compassionate and gentle with each other. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but I do think because it's a small community, it does present a hurdle to criticism, whereas, you know, if you get something published in New York by the Big Five, you know, any number of people can review it and they're never going to see you. They can say whatever they want about it. But I think, I don't know, it's a hurdle to that criticism because we're small and because we care about each other, right? We all want to support each other. We want to help each other out. That's my two cents. Person in the back.
You have
so I've been jumping back and forth between this and the debate, so I haven't heard everything. I may have been sorry. But what do you think is the role in Mormon literature of works by Mormon authors that are not explicitly Mormon? And when Nicole was asking who, you know, what's the first Mormon book you read, she specifically said not include Morrison Scott Card. But one of my early Mormon literature experiences is running into this science fiction series by Orson Scott Card that's the Book of Mormon in Space. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, like, he ripped off this story, and 90% of his readers will never notice, right? Because he's popular enough that most of his audience is not Mormon and probably doesn't even know that he's Mormon or.
No, everybody knows he's Mormon. Yeah. I don't think
well,
he
knows
that.
Well, now.
Yeah. He's pretty loud about it.
But I have right with me a book of Eric James Stone's short stories, which, you know, it's published as science fiction. It's got an introduction by another noted science fiction author. He's compared to Asimov on the back cover. But if you read some of these stories, like Leviathan of the Thou Art Made, Tabloid Reporter to the Stars, they're not necessarily specifically Mormon, but there's definitely ashes of their fathers. There's definitely meaning that's more significant for a Mormon audience than perhaps for other audiences. And so what's the place of this literature within Mormon literature, next to Mormon literature?
Well, and I think it's interesting, Matt, that you bring up genre literature. Because I think in a space like this, like with the AML, it's we kind of want to say there's literature, and then there's genre, and then there's like Deseret Book, right? And so we sort of separate things. Even though, you know, I'm an English teacher and I do that thing, I think that's part of the Mormon lit scene, personally. Because I think genre literature does have a lot it can do. And we probably need to wrap up, which is why James is outside the door. But I don't know if you guys, you guys read some Card in your class.
No.
And you mentioned genre authors.
Well, I think that the literary genre, like literary fiction, is its own genre.
Right. So. Right. And so that's why, yeah. I don't know. So I think maybe we, personally, what I would like to see, and I don't get to make the decision, so I don't have to, is just being more open to saying, is this piece a legitimate, you know, like. I've done scholarly work on comics. And I think being able to say stuff like, is this a legitimate piece of literature, even if it's not, like you said, Catherine, like literary fiction, can we still look at it in the way that Doug Thayer is saying here, as can we look at it critically? And I guess that's really the question. Can we look at this critically and see how it's functioning as part of the Mormon lit scene?
Well, I think that's why we interview artists, Mormon artists, because I think that our perspective is that anyone who is Mormon and who is creating art, that's going to be, Mormonism is going to be part of what they're creating. And oftentimes when we interview them, that comes up, you know, whether it's more explicit or implicit or just kind of Mormonism is an influence in their life, it's always going to be a part of that. So.
Okay, we really should wrap up. So the next panel can come in and Gideon needs to go.